from west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. Visit them on the web at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hello, and welcome to episode 79 of the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. I am your host and Diz historian, Michael Bowling, and I am joined by my co-host, producer, and good friend, Craig Williams. Craig, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you, Michael?
Oh, I'm doing well. So just, starting to get packed up, ready to head out to Orlando.
Absolutely. So yeah. Did you, with all the getting ready and stuff, did you have time to watch Mickey's 90th birthday spectacular on ABC this past weekend?
Oh, I was going to talk about that next week.
But... Oh, next week? Okay. Then
but
we will...
No, well, only... But no, let's... I'm only about an hour into it. I got to... The part where, I guess, K-pop is started to perform?
Yeah.
Is that the name of the boy band? I mean, they've just walked out on stage, and apparently every teenage girl inside that auditorium and for several miles around it are all screaming.
Yeah, that's actually right about where I turned it on. I missed the first half of it and picked it up with that point, and... At first, I just kind of like shrugged it off. I was like, I've been to TV tapings before. I know how they run you through the audience shots where they want you just clapping so they have cutaways and stuff. And then once I started to put it together and saw some of the wider shots, it's like, no, these people are actually losing their minds over this. And I don't get it.
Yeah, yeah. I know I've read about K-pop or seen them. I think they've been in Carol's People magazine or something. And I know they're big. I know they're a thing. So
yeah, I understand the appeal of K-pop. It's not for me musically. It's not something that I necessarily enjoy. But that was just one weird segment in an entire show that just felt... stranger than normal for a Disney special.
Well, I think a lot of it's how it clearly, because I saw what people were posting on the Diz about it, and I went into this with great trepidation.
hey, let's be honest, that was only Jackie.
because there weren't a lot of positive reviews, our listeners and folks who visit the boards, on that. And I sit there and we've talked about this before, my generation and all that, we're no longer the target audience for Disney. They have us hooked. They're done with us. I mean, it is the younger generation they're trying to bring in. And I think this special from the first hour I've seen clearly demonstrates that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
It's nice they threw in some history. I appreciated that, and they're throwing in some clips, but boy, when you see these beautiful renderings of the classic Mickey Mouse shorts, and then the current web versions of him, I just don't care for them. I don't care for the new ones at all, and I just don't see how they're going to hold up as classics. But anyway,
no, you're right. The torch has passed in terms of their target audience, and you know what? That's fine as long as they still find a way to respect their current audience from time to time. Give us that history every now and again. Give us throwbacks to the things that we loved about it. It's fine if they integrate everything they're trying to put into it now, but this was not what I expected from that show. D23, Jeffrey from D23 was nice enough to invite me and a guest to come out to that show, and I would have had to fly, and this was very shortly after I was in the hospital with my pulmonary embolism. So flying was out of the question for it. But after watching it, you know, I'm not trying to say anything too negative about it, but I don't know if I would have been satisfied traveling across the country in order to see that. So if I was a California local and I got invited, that would have been one thing. But it would have been a long way to see that interesting mix of entertainment.
Well, and I don't know who the young lady was in the giant poofy princess dress that sang, from Little Mermaid, the Look at the
Part
Stuff.
Of Your World.
Part of Your World. Oh my, I think she was having an asthma attack. I mean, I think she needed her inhaler. I have never heard someone sing so breathy. I don't know if that's her style or hauling her up on that giant swing like a big puffy teddy bear just took the wind right out of her. But, I'm so glad that Diz has enabled us to hear Jodi Benson sing. I don't know, the poor young thing. I hope her assistant had the inhaler ready when she was done.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I just looked it up. I don't remember watching that part. I might have blocked it out of my mind,
it
or
was
that was
the
before
very
I started.
First musical performance.
Okay, that's why I missed it. Yeah, it was Sophia Carson, of course, from Disney Channel's original movie Descendants. Of that fame.
That.
So that checks out. So
is that her style?
I
to sound
I
like she's wheezing.
I have not watched Descendants, but it would make sense. That's that is also one of the current styles that is in terms of singing. It's it's very, you know, it's interesting to see how music progresses and just changes with time. So I mean, you've lived through it more than I have, but even I'm seeing it now, and it sucks growing up. So, I guess that's the best way of saying
it. But there were, in between the wheezes, she had a very sweet voice, so she just needs to catch her breath before she starts.
I'm good. I'll check it out sometime.
There's my critique. There I am, the Simon Cowell of the Diz. Look.
It's excellent. It looks good on you.
Thank you. Well, speaking of Mickey Mouse and his 90th anniversary, of course, Destination D is almost here, and we do again want to. This will probably be the last time to remind our listeners about our informal Connecting with Walt meetup at Destination D.
Yeah, it will be by the time next week's episode is released. We will probably be well and done with our meetup, but just for everyone who hasn't heard it yet, or for those who have forgotten. At the Outer Rim Lounge at Contemporary on November 16th, that's at Friday, starting at 2 p.m., we're going to have our little unofficial meetup. Outer Rim Lounge, of course, is right beside to the left of Contempo Cafe, in the where you go to enter Chef Mickey's. So it's right on that main, the main floor of the Contemporary, which is that fourth floor. So if you're coming in from the ground level, you have to take the escalators up from the main lobby up to get to the fourth floor, the concourse level. And if you're coming from monorail, you have to just go down one quick escalator and you're on that concourse level. So like I've said in the past before, too, we're doing it at 2 p.m. So it gives you time to get over after lunch and just hang out. For as long as you want to, you can just literally stop by, say hi, and leave from there. But we'll be there for a little bit of time, and still give you time to head back into the parks, hit the rest of your fast passes that you have, grab dinner, all that good stuff. But yeah, we look forward to seeing everyone who shows up for it.
Yeah, by the time this show goes up, I will be at Walt Disney World. So I hope keep an eye out for me and say hello. And all that, maybe we can hang out for a bit. So anyway.
Yeah, so. I assume that I'll be in the bushes somewhere in the Magic Kingdom, still exhausted from last night's Mickey's Very Merry Christmas Party. So if you see me, just poke me. Tell me to go home.
Yeah, I'm going on the 13th. To Mickey's Very Merry Scary Christmas Party, whatever it's called.
Excellent.
You all have such complicated names out there.
Yeah, let's say, you know, if there's not extra words, then there's no extra fun. Sure.
So anyway, I also wanted to bring, I hadn't talked about the Walt Disney Family Museum in a little while, and I just wanted to remind folks about them, and also that if you've been thinking about becoming a member, 2019 would be a good time, because I just got the members only. You know, we get to get our tickets in advance. So I thought, you know, a membership for yourself or for your family would be a great holiday gift. I want to just tell you a little about what they are doing. The first quarter, if you're listening to this show, the first quarter of their programs are incredible. And I mean, you're going to want to put us on pause and go out and become a member. Because these are all going to sell out. Like for instance, January 5th, they're going to have Memories from the Children of the Nine Old Men. So their children are going to be at the museum, and it's going to be moderated by Don Hahn, who you might remember from an early episode of the show when he talked about the Nine Old Men, Walt's Nine Old Men exhibit there, because it's closing. And then members can also get tickets for a special reception with Don Hahn afterwards, and then wine and food. And then he's going to talk about his personal experiences with the Nine Old Men and how they impacted him and his career. So that's cool. Then on January 26th, they're doing a retrospective of Walt's life. And that should be fascinating. And then on February 2nd, they're talking about the Disney family history. And then, and I believe Becky Klein might be doing that one from the archives. And then March 30th, The Hand Behind the Mouse. It's all about Ub Iwerks. So with his family, it's actually going to be there to talk about him. So, you know, if you're going to be at the museum on any of these dates, try to get tickets. But really, if you're thinking about becoming a member or thinking about renewing, I just wanted to put in a plug for them because these are great programs. So, anyway.
No better time than right before Christmas to buy that too.
That's right. That's right. And you get discounts, you know, at their bookstore, and of course they have reciprocity agreements with other museums as well. So when you're a member at the Walt Disney Family Museum, so it's very cool. So, all right. Well, you know, every quarter, you know, we invite members of our Connecting with Walt family to become a part of the show by submitting questions for me and Craig to answer. And in our last episode, we answered questions about Disney theme parks and resorts. And this week, we are answering questions about Walt Disney's family, the Walt Disney Company, Imagineering, Disney films, and more. So, Craig, I started last time, so do you want to start this time?
Yeah. Do you have any particular category that you want to start off into? So, I know the Walt Disney one was first, and unfortunately, a lot of the questions we got regarding Walt was what would we think Walt would feel about parks and other stuff. So, you know, the message can't always get out to everyone.
Yeah, we just don't know what Walt would think. Because, you know, over the years, we saw Walt changed his mind.
Yeah.
A lot. So we have no idea. And even like projects Walt started, he dropped, he changed them, he lost interest in them and gave them to other people to carry on with. So that's just why we can't address those. That whole what would Walt think thing, we just don't feel we can address those with any confidence.
Yeah, but I do think you could answer Larry's, which was what Lillian did after Walt passed away. Did she remarry? Did she remain a presence at all in everything Disney?
You know, Lillian, actually after a couple of years, few years, she remarried. She married a dentist, and they were married for quite a long time until he passed. She really devoted herself to philanthropic works. She was involved in many, many charities. And she was also involved in really keeping Walt's name alive. She, you know, one of her last big charities that she did with her daughter Diane was, you know, the Walt Disney Symphony Hall. She really wasn't involved in the day-to-day operations or anything of the Walt Disney Studio or the Walt Disney Company. She certainly was aware of what was going on. She wasn't always happy with the direction it was going in sometimes, and she was vocal about it. And she, but you know, she would show up at, you know, like she was at, you know, she would show up for events, you know, whether it was rededications of the parks, anniversaries of the parks. She was there for the dedication of Epcot. She was very open about her thoughts of parks opening overseas. And she would get into what would Walt think. So that was it. She also talked a lot about how much she missed Walt. So even though she remarried and all that, you know, her first love was Walt. And she missed him. So that's what she did. So she kept very, very busy.
Mm-hmm. As she should. I mean, as anyone should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, do you want me to ask another one, or are you going to ask me one?
Let's see. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, go ahead.
Well, no, I thought, was there a related one? You just wanted a link to that one?
And no, not really. So, I saw that one, and it popped up, because I will be honest, I guess I'm kind of showing off how bad of a Disney fan I am. I didn't know if Lillian remarried. I don't know if that just never came up in anything I read or any conversations we had, but I was interested in it too. So I got my answer. So I appreciate that.
And I sort of drew in, Liz asked a very similar question.
Yeah.
So I tried to tie her question into that as well. So anyway.
I can ask you the next question if you would like. It's kind of jumbling a little bit of the Imagineering questions that we got. It's kind of a mixture between Rachel's and Elisa's, so I'll read them both in their order. So Rachel asked a lot of discussion centered around influential Imagineers. You really hear mention of influential Imagineers of today besides Joe Rohde. Who are some highly influential Imagineers of today, and what have they worked on? Compound that with Elise's. As Disney fans, we know all the legendary Imagineers like Exotencio, Bob Kerr, Tony Baxter, who are current Imagineers that aren't so well known that you consider to be future legends. So I feel like those two kind of combine into the same thing, almost the same category. So I didn't know if you had any thoughts. I've got just one or two, but then an abstract version of this.
Yeah, I don't keep up with the Imagineers, unfortunately, but I came across an article a while back on D23. It was 9 inspirational Disney Imagineers, and I think it was for Women's History Month. And so it covered some influential women Imagineers and all that, you know, like Sue Bryan. And because she, you know, she was involved in Mission Space and Toy Story Midway Mania. Marianne Buress, you know, she did Guardians of the Galaxy, Mission Breakout, and Soarin' Over California, and worked on several hotels for the international parks.
Yeah.
You know, Kim Irvine, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, probably almost everybody's heard of hers. But she redesigned a lot of the restaurants and things in Disneyland especially. And she was the first female recipient of the Buzz Prize Thea Award for a lifetime of outstanding achievements in the Themed Entertainment Association. But, you know, she started her career, you know, in the model shop working on It's a Small World for the Walt Disney World Resort. And she did a lot of color design for when Disneyland Resort's Fantasyland and Main Street USA was, redone.
Yeah.
And all that. So I'm just sort of going through here. Oh, Amy Jupiter. You can thank her for Pandora, the World of Avatar, and also Guardians of the Galaxy Mission Breakout. She worked on that. Another one that a lot of people have definitely heard is Kathy Magnum.
Yes, of course. You know,
she's worked on the Walt Disney World Resort, Disney Cruise Line, Disneyland Paris, Cars Land. Okay, that was one of her big thing. You know, the Living Seas with Nemo and Friends Pavilion at Epcot. You know, if you listen to last week's show, I'm not as enthusiastic about that version of the of it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing this young lady's name. Hilcia Pena, the Pirates of the Caribbean Battle for Sunken Treasure, Shanghai Disneyland. Oh my gosh. And she did, and also Hong Kong Disneyland's Grizzly Gulch, Toy Story Land, and Mystic Point. She's worked on huge, huge attractions. So there's, those are some. I mean, really, those are some female Imagineers who have delivered us some huge, huge experiences in the last few years.
Yeah. Yeah. And just compounding on that, too, I will personally say one Imagineer who is like a rock star to me, who I would consider to be influential. And if he's not considered a legend yet, he's. I don't know if he'll ever achieve that status, but at least for some people, he might. Jason Grant, who is an art director for Imagineering, and he made that really adorable the Disney storybook, Magic Kingdom storybook, that is just so adorable. But besides that, Jason, at least at some of the D23 panels I've been to, especially Destination D, he will get up and talk about Disney history, and he will steal the show with his love and passion for Disney parks. He is a Disney nerd, just like we all are, and he's one of those lucky ones who then got to make that his life and his career. On top of that, I cannot tell you the amount of times that I've been at like Disney Springs, and he's been with art students sketching all around Disney Springs. Like I've seen him by himself doing it, and I've seen him with groups. I don't know if it's up and coming Imagineers or art students from somewhere or what, but they'll be all sketching and just drawing early in the morning, random times. Like it's always so cool, because every time I go up, I've met him before at media events, and I've interviewed him once or twice. But it's never those times where I'm like super excited to talk to him. It's the times where you see him out and about at Disney Springs, just sitting there like wanting to know what he's working on, as he's sitting there taking in all of the surroundings. So to me, he is amazing. And you know, we're getting very close to Destination D here, and I know he's at least doing one panel at it, and it's one of the things I am looking forward to very greatly, to hear him speak again. Another Imagineer that I enjoy, and he's had an impact on both Universal and Disney now, especially, is J. Michael Roddy, who has really forefronted a lot of the projection shows that have come as lately. You know, his one baby was the Star Wars projection fireworks that are currently happening at Hollywood Studios. He's very, very big in this community. So way back in the day, he used to work on Halloween Horror Nights and Bill and Ted over at Universal Orlando. So he's very well known from that. And then compound that on now that he's doing so much in Imagineering. He's a big deal. So if you haven't seen interviews with him yet, it's as he keeps working, you're just going to see him more and more. And I guess the spinoff to that too is that I feel like, and this isn't necessarily how it is, but it's no surprise that Walt Disney Imagineering is still designing, creating, coming up with all of these ideas, but it's no longer out of the realm to just bring in people to help out with the projects that are happening. So I love Trader Brandon, who came in to help out with and help design Trader Sam's Enchanted Tiki Bar, and then he also helped design Grog Grotto here in Walt Disney World. He's also worked with Universal to design Volcano Bay with the tiki aspect. So there's people like him who are brought in to work these projects. There's a lot happening like that, where people are brought in for specific projects. And I don't want to say this is the norm, that everything is just third party. Now, that's not the case. But there is a lot.
Well, Garner Holt.
That's exactly what the first one I was going to bring up is, in terms of Imagineering, it might be Disney people coming up with the concept, Imagineers coming up with the concept of these animatronics, but it's Garner Holt bringing them to life. I want to hear about those people who are bringing these contraptions to life. I know a lot of the projection technology, that's done third party. I cannot think of the name of the people who are helping create everything going along with it, but a lot of that stuff is definitely contracted out. There are so many projects there are so many projects created all by Walt Disney Imagineering, but elements of those projects will be contracted out. That it's really, there's so many superstars out there, and I think that's why we don't know. It's not this team that's just doing everything.
Mm-hmm. And you have to think too, Imagineering isn't just making audio animatronic figures. That's what we all think of, but some of the beautiful lighting, the colors, the landscaping, and even more costuming that we all enjoy. Yeah, that's all Imagineering, and a lot of those are just unsung. They do extraordinary work, but we'll never know their names.
Yeah, and like the one sticks out to me all the time is back when I was still very new with the Diz. I think it was during one of the promotions with the Limited Time Magic, maybe, where I won a tour of Expedition Everest with an Imagineer. And your immediate thought is, okay, who's it going to be? Are we going in with the Yeti? Are we going to walk the track? What are we going to see? Like, who is it going to be? For the life of me, I could not tell you the name of the Imagineer that walked us around. I couldn't even tell you if it was male, female. I don't remember anything. All I remember is that they were in charge of the rock work. And so they spent their time going into the Himalayas and studying rock design to bring it back, to implement it. And not just that, but also brickwork, everything with that nature. So, as you say, it's an unsung position. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is one of the most unsung positions you can get, because you would think with something like that, it would be someone just drew it and they bring in contractors to come out and just make it happen. No, there's people out there studying every single detail to bring it to reality.
Well, and if you want to see how that artistry and technology has changed in rock work, look at the Matterhorn. Then look at Big Thunder Mountain, then look at Cars Land, look at Expedition Everest, and then Galaxy's Edge next year. And we're going to see an amazing progression, you know, of all of that.
Yep, and that's another example of when we say being contracted out in the way, it's with Galaxy's Edge, it is a joint cooperation worldwide between Walt Disney Imagineering, Lucasfilm, and then the people who are actually building everything and bringing it to life, finding the right characters' voices to come together. So it's it's Walt Disney Imagineering is still something very special, but mm-hmm. it's great also at the same time that Disney has opened the doors to so many other people, and because not everyone can be Imagineer, but that doesn't mean everyone can't help towards what Walt Disney is, Walt Disney World, mm-hmm. Disneyland, Disney parks are creating. And that's awesome in itself. It's all those people out there who are saying, I want to be an Imagineer one day. It's a way for them to get in the door without necessarily being an Imagineer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's big.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Is it my turn?
It's, yeah, that was a long one, but yeah, it's your turn.
All right. I think I might jump categories. Let me see here.
I think that's
and we
good
can
idea.
Always we can always return to a category too if we wanted to. I have to skip through all of the theme park and resort stuff. I should have had that at the end. I'm going to go into one that you probably the films Walt Disney Studio. Okay, so okay, this is one I'm just going to quickly sort of, I think, respond to this one about, just because this is something somebody wrote this to me and I said, could you please submit it as a question, so I want to make sure I actually answer it. And this is from Erin, and she wrote, I recently came across the Oswald cartoon Spooks, which is in 1930. I noticed some similarities to the Silly Symphony Skeleton Dance in 1929. I was wondering if you had any historical perspective on this. The beginning of Spooks looks like a parody of Skeleton Dance, with exaggerating tree branches waving in the wind, with the foreground cemetery cat blows a raspberry at the skeleton rather than being terrified, and the hooting owl, whom the phantom calls a fat-faced buzzard. The rest of the cartoons being largely a parody of Phantom of the Opera, yes. And it is. And, okay, Spooks was produced by Walter Lantz. We know him probably more famously as the creator of Woody Woodpecker, but he did the Oswald series until, like, 1943 or so. And this is also animated by several former Disney Studio staff members. The animation is not as refined as Iwerks, but you can definitely see the Disney touch in this. I'm surprised, Aaron, you didn't mention is the character that, wow, boy, that really looks like Mickey Mouse in this. But it's not Mickey Mouse, but it's Mickey Mouse in here. And whether it was a jab at Walt by Universal, I think having this little Mickey Mouse looking character in there, yeah, I think it probably was. If not by Universal, probably by some of the former staff. As a side note, Walt would reuse themes from Oswald for Mickey Mouse shorts, and so you want to keep an eye out for those. But the one that definitely borrowed heavily from the Skeleton Dance was actually another Mickey Mouse short that was in the same year, 1929, called The Haunted House. And Mickey goes into a haunted house and he's sort of forced by a phantom to play music. And then the skeletons start to dance to the music. Look very carefully at the skeletons dancing and then Skeleton Dance from earlier in the year. And it looks like they reused some of the same material. So there's just that one in there. So.
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, okay, Greg, I think that, Craig, this might be an, I know this could be a full episode, but Becca writes, I'm interested in learning more about older Disney films. Everything from the first Mickey cartoons and Silly Symphonies to live-action films such as Bedknobs and Broomsticks, which I watched a lot as a kid, and then she goes on. What would you recommend watching as a good base to start expanding my Disney film repertoire? I really enjoyed your discussion of Turner Classic Movies lineup recently, and so maybe I should go back and listen to past episodes as well. Oh, absolutely, Becca, starting with episode one. Go back. So I guess, Craig, are there some must-see animated and live action that you would recommend to Becca?
The first thing when I thought of underrated animated led to a couple things. it obviously Halloween was just right upon us, so one of the things I had to do was dig out my Blu-ray copy of Mr. Toad, Ichabod and Mr. Toad,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's absolutely something that should be watched if you haven't really gotten there yet, along with, on the Blu-ray pack, if you have the multi-pack, that also came with Fun and Fancy Free, which is also very, very wonderful. You know my love of Saludos Amigos and Three Caballeros. I think in terms of underrated, I don't know if you can get much more underrated than them, but that's just my opinion. I think those are obviously a place to start. I would even say to get that full appreciation of both aspects of Walt Disney as a company and then the animated side is you have to watch The Reluctant Dragon. And
yes,
the full going all along with going to the Walt Disney Studios, learning about the ink and paint process, everything with it, seeing the full way through, Clarence Nash in there doing Donald, just everything. It's amazing. And one that's been really sticking out to me, it's not by any means at all lesser known or underrated in terms of animated movies, but something in the past like 6 months has kicked with me in Alice in Wonderland that it's just really been resonating with me. And I've watched it for so many years, and it's just it's always good, but nothing like that makes it my favorite. But lately, especially the music, the music pretty much is the biggest part of it. It just, mm-hmm. I love it so much. It's really, really growing on me. And then in terms of underrated live action, that's a
black hole.
Yeah, clearly a black hole. You know how much both Michael and I love that. I'm going to let you go first, and I'm going to think about an underrated live action, because I didn't know if we were going to bring this one up. I thought we were just going to be like, no, go back and listen to the past episodes and leave it at that.
Well, you know, of course, if you haven't watched, some of the major classic ones, like Snow White, Pinocchio, definitely go back and watch those in animated. A couple of the underrated ones. Okay, this could either be live action or animated, but thing is, you're going to have to get a bootleg copy or find it on YouTube. Song of the South. This was, first of all, all the crap you hear about this film is not true. So you're going to have to do, we've talked about what the background story really is for this, and so we don't need to go into that again. Definitely listen to a past episode on that. The way it blends the story and animation is so beautifully rendered. This is also probably, I just think some of the animation itself is excellent. And, you know, there's an attraction based on this at most Disney theme parks around the world now. And so I would say definitely try to get that one. Some other ones that I'm just trying to think that are underrated. Hunchback of Notre Dame, because that is so different from things that any other Disney animated film.
See, and since I grew up with that, I would never consider that underrated, but that's just because of my personal childhood. So anyone who was born in the late 80s, mid 80s, and grew up during the 90s, I think they have an obsession with that entire,
really?
The entire Renaissance run. Yeah.
I think my generation sort of overlooks it a bit. I loved Meet the Robinsons. I thought it was a great story. I thought the animation was terrific. I thought the character development was really well done. I love this film, and it's very entertaining. I liked Brother Bear. I thought it was beautifully rendered, and it was a nice story. It was predictable.
Yeah, I'm not as big of a fan of Brother Bear, which is a shame because Strange Brew, Bob and Doug McKenzie, one of my favorite duos, and Strange Brew is one of my favorite comedies to watch. But it never really resonated with me the way I wanted it to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so have you thought about live action?
I unfortunately have a really big list for live action now. You gave me too much time there. Okay. And some of these are not necessarily underrated or lesser known. It's just the ones that jump out to me. Of course, any full-length Disneyland episode that you can get, Wonderful World of Color, Walt Disney Presents episodes, those are all just you have to watch. And if you watch the TCM Treasures from the Disney Vault, you're going to stumble upon those eventually. But one we've talked about on this show before, The Great Locomotive Chase. Absolutely love that movie. Johnny Tremaine was really, really wonderful as well, too. Third Man on the Mountain, if you're a Matterhorn fan, is something that you have to seek out to watch. It is very bad, and I feel terrible for the poor chimpanzee who had to go through the filming of it, but Lieutenant Robinson Crusoe is just amazing. And
written by Walt Disney.
No, just it is so perfect. It's entertaining, and you know it's easily Dick Van Dyke's second best Disney movie after Mary Poppins. And that was the big one.
I have big four that I feel are must sees for live action. Swiss Family Robinson. Oh, maybe it's five. Treasure Island. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
I was going to put Darby O'Gill on my list, but that's one I struggle with. I don't know if I really love it, and I just didn't really discover it until I was a little older, or if it's something that everyone kind of discovered early on. Yeah. So that's why I didn't mention it, but I love... I will skip going out on St. Patrick's Day just to sit in and watch Darby O'Gill.
Yeah. And the fifth one, Old Yeller. I feel those are the five Disney classic live action films you must see.
Yeah.
So,
Oh, and another random one I forgot, Return to Oz, if you haven't seen that before.
I do like that one.
So, newer, but it's a good one. So, that was a good question.
Yeah, that was very good.
I'm going to ask you a tough one that kind of goes, still talking about movies, a brilliant original, but we'll see how the new one is taken. But Levi asked, what are our thoughts moving into Mary Poppins Returns? Levi's excited for it, but
I saw that.
Looks like it captured the brilliant original. We're still not quite to the release date as of the time that we're recording and releasing this, but we have plenty of trailers out there now. Michael, where are you at on there?
I don't know. Did we really need Mary Poppins to return? No. The first one for me was just, it was such a perfect film. I am really nervous that if this isn't, it can't even be practically perfect in every way. This has to be perfect in every way, because I don't want the original to be tarnished in any way by a substandard Mary Poppins Returns. I'm not, who is it, Emily Blunt? Who's playing Mary Poppins?
Yes, it's Emily Blunt.
I don't know. She's no Julie Andrews. And that's not bad. But she's coming off of, I don't know. But
I think she has that. I think she has the attitude of Julie Andrews. But I just recently had the chance. Rhino and I were discussing this. That's why I thought it would be fun for you and I to get in on this too. Mm-hmm. But I recently showed him the SNL clip from a few years back when. And why is her name escaping me right now? From Princess Diaries and Les Miserables. Somewhere out there, someone's just screaming at the top of their lungs right now. what her name
is. I can see her, too.
I really hate that I can't remember it. And I'm trying to... Anne Hathaway. Mm-hmm. There we go. I was way too late on that. On SNL a few years back, they did a Mary Poppins sketch with her on that. And even though it was doing a cheesy comedy version of the English accent and stuff, she just... Something about her has the look, the feel, everything about Mary Poppins. Maybe it's because she worked with Julie Andrews on the Princess Diaries movies, but there's something about her that's like, that would have been the first one I went to. But Emily Blunt, I feel like she gets the snarky side of Mary Poppins, and that's a very important
about.
But that's also important to have.
But there has to be, but it has to be balanced with a touch of sweetness, and that's not coming through to me in the trailers.
Well, the trailers have been kind of a mess. I feel like they are showing that snarky side a lot, and the other thing too, they're showing a lot of the animated portions of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think to trap us in this sense that, like, oh, we're taking these characters and we're putting them in animated worlds, so it should feel familiar. It should feel like it did before. But it's even the shooting process on it is different. This. Maybe I'm wrong, but this looks completely digital to me. And
the animation is digital, and they actually called back folks like the people that, like some of the ladies that worked in ink and paint and all that, for them to be consultants as to how to get the look of the hand drawn and the hand colored digitally.
Then,
so it is not hand-drawn animation.
So then that's double bad, because it's not hand-drawn animation. And then on top of that, even the camera for the live-action portions of it with Emily Blunt and Lin-Manuel Miranda and the other stars, if you're also shooting that on digital too, you're going to have this very clean look without a lot of a film grain. And that's a huge aspect of it. If you watch back to Mary Poppins and you see those scenes, that graininess to it, that realism to it, kind of it helps blend those two worlds together. With these trailers, a lot of what we're seeing, it looks like flat static animation with these characters that look too realistic. In terms of the animated characters and the actual live action stars with it, it all looks too separate, too real. It doesn't look like it's blending together like it did in the original movie. And if you're going to promote that much, then these need to be the scenes that sell the movie. And I'm worried about that.
Yeah. And what's with Michael Banks and that porn star mustache? I mean, seriously.
I can't say much since I'm rocking the stash right now. Well, but
yeah, it's not like what that character's wearing. I mean, it looks like it's a Halloween mustache that they use spirit gum to put on that young man.
It's a little intense.
Yeah, and I'm also worried that they're reusing too many of the themes from the Christopher Robin film about, you know, the parents, you know, the father that's too busy with life in order to pay attention to his children, and that's why Mary Poppins, you know, pays a visit, which was also. And you know, the theme, of course, is that, and this was brought out in Saving Mr. Banks and all that, the theme was that, you know, it was really the redemption of the father, you know, in that it was about. And I'm worried that they're just repeating the themes from the original film, from Christopher Robin and all that, and there's going to be a predictability to it.
Yeah, it's. I will just say it's tough going in. I have some faith in Rob Marshall. I feel like he has done a couple things that were good. I personally understand why people love Chicago and why it did so well with awards and such, with nominations and all that. And I don't like Chicago, though, the movie. I just don't care for it all. It is not my speed.
If I see Mary Poppins dancing around in a bustier, I'm walking out of the theater.
I think a lot of people will, but that's arguably his biggest credit, and it's something I don't care for. He also did make Memoirs of a Geisha, which I thought was completely beautiful. I enjoyed Into the Woods, but I didn't really have the actual musical as a preface to it. My first experience with Into the Woods was the movie, so I walked away enjoying it. Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides is right up there as the worst Pirates movie, with At World's End, so that's not a great one. I did not care for Nine either, so that's it in terms of him directing. And then Mary Poppins Returns. So he doesn't, in my opinion, he doesn't have a solid track record, but I have faith in him. But this, it could go horribly wrong.
Yeah, but Levi, I hope you are absolutely right that it's captured the essence of the brilliant original film, because I agree with you. The original film was brilliant. I mean, it was just, I love it. It's one of the cherished films from my childhood, and I don't want anything to ruin that. So I'm hoping this is worthy of that film.
Yes.
So even though we're sort of down on it, I'm really hoping it's good.
The more I'm being overly critical about it now, I know deep down when I walk into the theater to see it for the first time, if I have the lowest expectations, I am way more likely to walk out enjoying it. And so, yeah, I guess that's part of what's happening in my head right now. Yeah. If I walk in thinking I'm going to hate it, I probably will enjoy it. And so going with that.
So, yeah. So Levi, let us know afterwards, right? Me and Craig, and let us know what you think of it afterwards. So,
absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Is it yours?
I asked you about Mary Poppins.
Okay. Let's see. A lot of these I'll have very short answers for. One I'll just answer. Connor, love the episodes over Oswald and Mickey. Thank you. Are there any chance there will be one about Donald Duck or others? Oh, yeah, I'm sure there will be. Absolutely. But we have to get through Mickey, and he has a very long career.
Yeah, we will be there in 2023.
Yeah, let's hope I'm still around in 2023. But let's see. I'm just sort of going through here. I don't know. See, some of these are, I don't want to make any more movies based on theme park attractions.
Yeah. There's one from Ross that I think is an interesting discussion.
Okay. Oh, okay. And this one. In your opinion, what defines a Disney movie? Are the Pixar films Disney movies? What about the Marvel or the new Star Wars films? Pretty Woman? Pulp Fiction. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay. If Mary Poppins Returns has the ending of Pulp Fiction, I'm leaving the theater. Well,
I assume at some point Mary Poppins is going to get an adrenaline injection straight to the chest. Otherwise, what kind of movie is it going to be?
Well, maybe that's how she gets to that ceiling in the tea party scene.
Go ahead, Craig. I think this actually is, it's very topical right now, because as these properties are being bought out, with Marvel, Star Wars, Pixar, now Fox, these lines are starting to get blurred by people who aren't us. And I did notice it recently when Pixar, I'm sure lots of people out there play it, HQ. The trivia game on your phone where you can win money and stuff. You know, of course I play it when I'm available to and such. And they've had a couple popular Disney nights. And so when it's Disney night, I don't expect Pixar questions. And then, of course, out of nowhere, they ask a question about Jerry's Game, the Pixar short.
Oh,
I'm like, well,
yeah,
that's great, but this is Disney night, not Pixar night. So that shouldn't be a question at all. And then that was the defining moment for me. It's like, does the average person truly not see the difference? We always make the joke, oh yeah, you know, Ice Age, that's a great Disney movie, or Shrek, that's one of the best Pixar movies to ever exist. But are we really, even though they're finding their way into Disney parks more and more now, does the average person still not understand the difference between different studios? I think they do with Marvel and Star Wars, but specifically with Pixar. Is it time where we start just lumping it all together because the masses can't tell the difference? Or what? Like, and I don't want that to be a thing. I don't want it to be Walt Disney Studios presents a Star Wars movie or a Marvel movie, mm-hmm. or Walt Disney. Like, I don't want to see that, but are we getting less inclined as a society to accept different studios as being separate when Disney is the one that's distributing everything? So it is very complicated, because Pixar didn't have to go with Disney. They could have worked with them on Toy Story and then cut a distribution deal with anyone else, and we wouldn't be here to this
happened.
Day. Yeah. Yeah. And the same goes for Marvel, Star Wars, Fox, all of that. These things are all tricky. It's why we have a mess that DreamWorks has just been all over the place the past couple of years, bouncing around to mm-hmm. who's going to distribute DreamWorks movies. And then you have the mess on Universal, I think, right now. Well, Universal owns DreamWorks Animation. They were working with live action, but right before that, Disney was releasing DreamWorks live action.
Yes.
So it's all over the place. So should we dumb it down? Like, and just make everything a Disney movie? Or should we keep it separate?
No, like, he brings up Pretty Woman. Well, that was Touchstone. And that was created because they wanted to, Ron Miller, not Michael Eisner, wanted to create a studio, basically, that where they could release more adult themed films that were not a Disney movie, that didn't fall into the parameters and concept of a Disney movie, because Disney is family friendly. It's something everybody can go to, from the toddler to great grandma and grandpa, and enjoy it together. And I don't think you can say that about all these films. I love the Marvel films, and I love the Star Wars films, but, you know, my granddaughter can't enjoy some of these until she reaches a certain age. And and Pulp Fiction, I will never take her to see Pulp Fiction. And I don't know if and films that were made prior to Disney taking them over, you know, I don't know if I'll ever consider Shrek will never be in a Disney film.
No, but hopes that Disney doesn't absorb Universal so they can ever get that. Who knows? They have money.
Yeah, you never know. But no, I think that Disney created, they have these different studios in order to release a certain brand, a certain type of film. And Disney is has its unique brand and its unique target audience. I think it's blurred between Disney and Pixar.
Yeah.
I think they have the same target audiences.
Well, that's also why I don't like using the hyphen of Disney Pixar. If you're going to use Disney Pixar, it should be Disney Marvel, Disney Star Wars. That shouldn't be.
And I don't think anybody wants that.
Yeah, and Disney, I get why it started, because it was also a rough time for their animation. Mm-hmm. And associating themselves more with Pixar was a really good thing, but now, you know, Pixar's track record isn't always great. And
but going back to Mary Poppins Returns, our previous question, I think... I think that Mary Poppins Returns, if I remember correctly, is the first time Walt Disney Animation and Pixar Studios have worked together.
Oh.
On a film. I'm almost positive I read that when I was working on something.
Yeah.
So,
but I think ultimately what defines a Disney movie, in the broader sense, if it's been distributed by Disney, you could call that a Disney movie, and that even includes some of the terrible movies that were released that were made by a different animation company that were just released under the Walt Disney banner. Was the one Valiant? I can't.
Oh,
even,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like stuff like that. Yeah, technically, that was distributed by Disney, wasn't made by them. If it was made by Walt Disney Live Action or Walt Disney Animation, it's a Disney movie. If it was made by Disney Pixar, it's a Pixar movie that was released by Disney. And the same goes with Marvel and Star Wars. They're Marvel movies, Star Wars movies released by Disney. So, and that's the correct way. That's the way I would look at it. I'm sure that's the way you look at it, Michael. But
yes,
that's the only reason I ask the question is, should we just dumb it down? Is because we're also more in the know than the average person. Is Disney eventually going to say we can tap more of these people if we just throw the Disney banner around on everything? And I'm afraid that that day is in our future.
I think it is, as they bring it into the theme parks.
Yeah.
Because they're bringing in all these different studio products into the theme parks. Look at, look at Galaxy's Edge. Look at the Marvel themed lands that are being built at several parks around the world.
Synergy is a double-edged sword.
Yeah. It is. Wow. And it's an overused word.
Well, I'm sorry for overusing it, but I believe it's my turn to ask. I suggested that one, but I still need to ask you one. I'm moving down to the Mouselanious.
Okay.
Just, we are getting close to running out of time, so I know there's one question that we'll probably save for last from Mark. In regards to Destination D. So I'm only going to ask you this next one because I want to talk about it more, but I'm interested in your thoughts too, because I believe you have some experience with this, or at least you should. But it comes from Casey saying, do you still think they should be making Disney sing-along songs? Why or why not? Casey still watches them on YouTube because it's nostalgic to the era they grew up in.
Casey, I still have all our VHS tapes of these things. I can't play them because we don't have a VHS. Well, I think we do. I just don't think it's plugged in. I think they should make them. My children love those things and watch them over and over again. Our granddaughter loves it. We had to buy the DVD of the Disneyland 50th anniversary one. They branded it as the 50th anniversary one, but it was the Disney sing-along. It was the same one. They just threw the logo on it for the 50th anniversary. Yeah. And because she loved that one so much, the Haunted Mansion one, that scared her. Now she would find it mundane. But I think they should make them. I think they're a lot of fun. I think the children love them. They like to learn the words. And boy, and it was great when I was making dinner. I needed like 20 minutes. I could just throw one of those sing-alongs in there and say, why don't you watch this for a few minutes? So I just finish up getting dinner ready.
Yeah.
And stay out of the kitchen. So anyway. I like them.
I could define my childhood by a couple different things. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, my son.
For sure. Disney sing-along songs would be one. I just can't understate how important these were to me. Still to this day, when I'm in a really, really bad mood and I just need to wind down and smile, you know, I have lots of stuff to help with that. But one of the things I will immediately go to is there is at least one good copy of Disneyland Fun on YouTube that I can always sit down and watch, and it is just instantly transporting me back to my childhood. And I didn't even go to Disneyland when I owned a copy of that VHS. I hadn't made it there yet, but I felt like I knew Disneyland before I ever got to go there, because from the second that video kicked off with walking right down the middle of Main Street USA through the Zippity Doodah rap and thinking that there was ghost trees and really spooky characters coming out on the Haunted Mansion lawn at night, to wrapping things up with When You Wish Upon a Star, and seeing the carousel still moving right through the castle and all that. Like, that, I had preconceived notions of Disneyland before I ever made it there because of that VHS tape. So that's how important it was to me. But even beyond that, I think one of the very few kids VHS tapes that my grandpa had, he was really into renting movies and then making bootleg copies of them, of course, which lots of people love to do in the late 80s and early 90s. But one he did that with was the very first sing-along song. So that was my first exposure to Pirates of the Caribbean that I can remember, to the point that they had Yo-Ho, Yo-Ho, A Pirate's Life for Me on that. But at the end, like, that mixed in the classic ride-through footage. And at the end, like, I was always confused then, when I went on the Disney World version, why the part at the end where they're shooting at each other wasn't happening. And then in that sing-along song, eventually he shoots the dynamite and the barrel explodes. And I couldn't understand why that didn't actually happen when I would go on Pirates, let alone that the scene didn't exist at all, which eventually I got to see in Disneyland. But it's like, that's how ingrained they are. And we bought all of them, and just so many, even through Mulan and all of that. It was something that was guaranteed to make us happy. And I think they should be making them. However, I don't think on home releases anymore. I think that there is still a case for that release some Blu-rays, especially the classics ones. Again, if I can get Disneyland Fun on a Blu-ray, I know it was shot on VHS and all that, so it's not going to be good quality regardless, but I love it so much. But if they would just make these for YouTube as playlists with high-quality versions, make it easy for kids to access, for adults to access even, this could be so popular, because I do see the view count on these full-length releases that people upload to YouTube of the old ones. There's still a market. Back when Frozen came out, we talked about Let It Go, I believe, last week. One of the big videos that they released with it was Let It Go with in every language with the subtitles. And we're getting sing-alongs released in the theaters. There was the Frozen sing-along that came out. People love the idea of the sing-along. So why it's not more prevalent, to me, it makes no sense. But yeah, I think it should be a YouTube series that they're constantly being released on there through the Disney app, once that's a big thing. It might not be enough to... Yeah, it might not be enough to release it on physical copies, but digitally, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and maybe on Disney Plays, maybe if they get desperate, they'll...
they'll do it. Listen, if Disney's not going to do it on themselves, then they can hire me out as a third-party contractor to come up with it and put some text in front of songs that already exist. So I will do the hard work. I am going to get paid for it, of course. I'm not doing it for free. But someone out there might do it for free.
Yeah. Alrighty. Sounds good.
Okay. So, well, do we want to do... We can probably go into the last question now, because it might take a little bit of time.
Okay. Well, Mark asked, do you have any strategy or planning suggestions for the upcoming Destination D event? So, Craig, do you have planning strategy or planning suggestions?
As long as you have a ticket, you're going to have a great time.
Yeah.
And you're planning on showing up to our meeting Friday.
Yes, 2 p.m. Absolutely. Yeah, this is not like the D23 Expo, Mark, where it's like every man for himself.
Absolutely not.
It's like the Disney Thunderdome. I mean, this is, you know, everybody is guaranteed a seat. All the seats are pretty good. I would recommend one of the strategies is do that. If you can, do that early check-in on Friday, because they will have some, you know, because they'll have the archives. You know, they always have a little display. Nothing is on the scale of the D23 Expo. But there'll be some vendors there. You know, Imagineering will be there and all that. So, you know, if you want to get there early and check things out, and, you know, check out the archives and all that, and what do they have on display. Again, it won't be huge like the archive display at the D23 Expo. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was all in one small room last time.
As well as the year before that, yeah.
Yeah. And but otherwise, you know, if you want to get in line early, because if you're someone that wants to sit, you know, right behind the, what do they call them this year? The high-priced package? Is it the Mouseketeer package or something?
Yeah, I think it's that.
Mickey Mouse Club package, something like that. I mean, if you really want to sit, like, right there, you're fine. But, you know, every seat is a good seat. I like to sit on the aisle. Because, you know, at my age, I never know when I have to go to the bathroom. But, and also, I just need to stretch out my legs sometimes.
Yeah, that's me,
but,
too.
Yeah, but otherwise, you know, it's, you know, there's also, they had, at the last Destination D, they had some sort of freestanding scenes that were photo ops you could sit in. Like, they had a Jungle Cruise one. They had some fun ones. So if you want to avoid some of the lines of getting the photos in there, you can get there a little early. But again, you're not waiting long for anything.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
The only problem was meals. At lunchtime, they didn't have a lot of options for grabbing lunch. They had one buffeteria kind of thing where you could get, you know, there on the same floor as the Destination D event. Otherwise, you had to go up into the Contemporary at one of the restaurants there. So if there's someplace, you know, you might want to make plans for that.
Yeah.
You know,
but. Well, that's where I was going to come in with a lot of extra stuff, too. You hit it right on the head. Every seat is fine. The one I attended, I guess that was 2014 now, which it doesn't feel that long ago, but I guess it was. I did have a seat up front, which that required me to get a spot early. You know, not waiting in lines and lines and lines. It was just get in, get a spot, and be willing to sit for like a half an hour before the first panel starts. And it's great sitting up front. That way you can see the panel on the stage. But I also did sit in the back just to see what it was like doing it then. And it's not terrible either. You're mainly looking at video screens, but you hear everything just as well. And ultimately, as long as you can see the screens and you can hear, you are getting the full experience. You very rarely do you need to see the people to be able to enjoy what they're saying. A lot of times they're referencing what's on the screens anyways. So really, don't get hung up about seating. As Michael said too, it's choosing that aisle seat, it's convenience to get up, but I would say a benefit of sitting in the back is these are long days. It's you essentially get in your seat first thing in the morning, and it's kind of at least the year I went, it was that understanding that this was your seat for the day, and people were very respectful of that. So they weren't switching seats, weren't moving up. If there was openings up there, they respected that that's where you sat, and they were going to keep it that way. So if you do sit further back, you're able to, if you sit very far back to the point where there's no one behind you, you're able to stand up. You're able to stretch out. You can still do that in the front. Just be aware that you're going to block people. It's all indoors. So, as always, layer up. You might not need it, but you don't want to be sitting in a freezing cold room if for some reason they're able to get it extremely cold. So, yeah. Definitely bring layers. On top of that, as you mentioned, snacks. Unfortunately, as great as the Contemporary is, and it has a lot of access to places right around there, when it comes to lunchtime, Contempo Cafe gets flooded. If you don't have a reservation for the Wave, you're probably out of luck at this point, because that will also get flooded. People run to the Magic Kingdom to try to get a spot. They will go to the other resorts on the monorail to try to get quick service. I even, the year that I was there for it, we even ran out to Crossroads, which it took a drive. That was back when they were still allowing people to park at Contemporary for the event. This year they're saying everyone has to park at the Magic Kingdom parking lot. So that kind of rules that out, unless you do like Uber. or Lyft, then maybe you can get off property to get food, but you don't have a lot of time, and every place that's around right by is going to be very busy. So just plan on being patient with getting food, maybe stepping out a couple minutes before the last panel before lunch is done, or if there's a panel you're not interested in as much, be willing to skip that for lunch or dinner, whatever you have to do with that. Just keep that open, because things will be crazy. But there's also one way around that: pack snacks. There's nothing that says you cannot bring snacks. Just it's if you care to carry it, then you can have it. And going off that, I say bring lots of water.
Yes.
As much water as you can find, and reasonably carry, bring that. On top of that, if you have a hydro flask or any hot slash cold water container that keeps things hot for a really long time or cold for a long time, bring coffee or tea in that too, because as great as these panels are, even the ones you're super excited for, it only takes one presenter who is very calming in the way they speak and very very genteel with their inflections to get you to start to nod off in the middle of a panel, especially if you've been sitting for like 5 hours and it just feels like the same thing over and over again. It's really nice to have that boost of coffee and caffeine or tea in the middle. And so just things like that. They're long days, but they are so much fun. I wish D23 Expo could be Destination D. I obviously love aspects of D23 Expo a lot in terms of what they offer. But Destination D, I feel like when D23 says they are the fan club for Disney fans, for true Disney fans, I feel like Destination D is the true event for Disney fans, because it's limited, but everyone gets a seat and gets included, and it is just hours and hours and hours of sitting and listening to history, to the future, to the interesting subjects that the average Disney fan doesn't care about at all, but we do because we love Disney. So it's a very special event and very, very worth going to. So I'm glad Mark's going.
Me too. And Mark, I hope you join us at our meetup, and as well as everyone else who's going to be there. And we'll look forward to meeting you and seeing you there. So, and I think that brings us to a close for this this quarter of our Q&A. And so thank you, everybody. You all had such great questions. We apologize that we could not get to all of them. But, you know, we will have another Q&A session in 2019 in the first quarter. So if we didn't get to your question then, you know, resubmit it, unless you come up with an even better question. Mm-hmm. And then we will, we'll see. We'll do our best to get to it then. Here we go. We're now back to this day in Disney history. There's a lot going on towards the end of November in Disney history. Because of everything that's going on right now, you heard Craig talk a little about, you know, some of the stuff that he's been up to, and I'm you know, packing up to head out to Orlando. We're doing our alternate format where I just throw out some questions to Craig, and we're going to see what a whiz he is in his Disney history. So, Craig, are you all set for the week of November 11th?
I'm as ready as I could be.
All righty. Okay. On November 11th, 1956, Walt Disney appears as a mystery guest on a TV game show. It's hosted by John Daly, and it is one of the earliest successes of Mark Goodson, Bill Todman Productions. What is the name of this TV game show?
I am aware of his appearance on the show. But for the life of me, I cannot think of the name of it. And I'm doing my best to stall.
Yeah, so you know, they have panelists of celebrities.
Exactly.
They ask questions. And they're blindfolded.
Oh, that's exactly, yeah, I can picture it in, they're kind of like 20 questions in a sort.
I think Arlene Francis was on the show for like 4 decades as one of the panelists.
it's not coming to me.
And it's funny, the name is Question, too.
Oh, it's just Question?
The title of the of the show is a question. It's What's My Line?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and that pops up on YouTube. Somebody posts that every once in a while. It'll come into my recommended.
Yeah, I want to say that's where I saw it. So I've seen it a couple times. For some reason, it's way after it, but I just wanted to say Password over and over again.
Oh, and that is a Mark Goodson, Bill Todman production.
Not the right one.
All right. Well, now let's go on to November 12th, 1939, this time. Actor Bela Lugosi, best known for his early portrayals of Dracula, spends the day at the Walt Disney Studio as an animator's model for which Disney animated character? This is November 12th, 1939.
I've actually never heard of him being a stand-in for any character, and that's surprising because I absolutely love monsters, as I've talked about on this show before, all the classic monsters, and especially Bela Lugosi. If you haven't seen Ed Wood, it stars Johnny Depp, it's a Tim Burton movie, regardless of your thoughts on Johnny Depp now, this was back in the 90s when it was made, and it follows the awful director Ed Wood and him coming into contact with Bela Lugosi at the end of his life. Like, it just gave me even more of appreciation for him, but I have zero idea. I can't even think of anything that would fit this.
Well, it is. I can give you a hint. It's my favorite Disney villain. I've talked about who my favorite Disney villain is.
Is it Chernabog?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was their intent. it was the intent that Bela Lugosi be the model for the demon Chernabog in the Night on Bald Mountain segment of Fantasia. However, Bill Tytla, who is the animator in charge of Chernabog, was later dissatisfied with Lugosi's performance. And he had sequence director Wilfred Jackson pose for the cameras. So it will be Wilfred Jackson and not Lugosi who, you know, appears, and that's sort of in quotes, you know, on screen as Chernabog.
Yeah. Thanks.
Although when you see the eyes of Chernabog and the face and all that, I still think that looks like Bela Lugosi.
Oh, I could agree with that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Okay. All right. November 13th, something a little more contemporary. Which popular ABC network television show did the cast of Newsies make their West Coast debut by performing Seize the Day?
I believe I remember this. If I am correct, was this on Dancing with the Stars?
It was very good. That's right.
Yeah. I remember watching it. I didn't watch Dancing with the Stars. I still don't watch Dancing with the Stars, but I remember seeing the clip of it.
Yeah. I used to watch Dancing with the Stars with Carol, but I lost interest in it years ago. So
I watched the Disney Nights, and I watched the year Bill Nye was on. And I've watched bits and pieces of it, but it's never been something I could get into weekly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, on November 14th, 1984, the Disney Channel premiered a series that was a continuation or a sequel, depending on how you looked at it, to a popular television series that aired in the 1950s and 1960s, and also a 1983 CBS television movie. What is the name of the original series and the Disney Channel series?
I don't know. had me hooked into something, and then when you said, when he said it was a series before, I, with 1984, I just genuinely don't know. Yeah, I don't even have a guess.
Well, the Disney Channel premiered the series Still the Beaver. And the first episode was Growing Pains. This is a sitcom sequel to the 1950s and 60s series Leave It to Beaver. And they had also done CBS had done a 1983 television movie as a follow-up, sort of catching us up with the family. That was depressing. Ward had died. The Beaver was getting a divorce. His wife was like leaving him and the kids, and we never saw her again. Wally was impotent.
Oh.
And they were, he and was it Mary Ellen, whatever his girlfriend was from the original series, they were trying to have kids, but poor old Wally just wasn't up for it. I mean, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh. So, and I think June ran for town council. So, the Disney Channel series sort of restarted things. And although Jerry Mathers, the Beaver, was still divorced, but the new series focused on Wally Cleaver, Tony Dow, and his younger brother Theodore Beaver Cleaver. Jerry Mathers are all grown up with families of their own. Still the Beaver will only last for 1 year on the Disney Channel before it's picked up by TBS for another 4 seasons.
So. Obviously I know Leave It to Beaver, but I've never heard of Still the Beaver.
And oh, it's I'm worth watching. Glad.
Oh, it's worth watching.
Well, the 1983 one is depressing. The 1983 CBS television movie, if they locked that up and forgot about it, it would be fine. The new series was pretty good. I think, was it Lumpy? Was that? No, who is Beaver's sort of chubby little friend who disappeared after 2 or 3 seasons? Was it Clarence?
Rutherford? I know who you're talking about, but I
apparently he ran off and joined a cult, and so they brought him back. He was still a cult member, dressed in his cult clothes and all that. It was fascinating. So anyway, but that was it. So I don't. It's probably on YouTube somewhere. Might be worth catching.
I'll try to find an episode.
Yeah. Okay. So let's look at November 15th. On November 15th, 1965, Walt and Roy Disney make an announcement to the press. What is this announcement?
I have a feeling I know what it is. Is it the announcement of Walt Disney World?
It is. Okay. Well, that was Disney World at the time, yeah.
Yeah.
At 2 p.m., November 15th, 1965, Walt and Roy Disney, accompanied by Governor Hayden Burns, they speak to the press in the Egyptian room of the Cherry Plaza Hotel. It all sounds so exotic. On Lake Eola in Orlando, and officially launched the Disney World project in Florida. Site preparation will begin the fall of 1967, and as we know, the park opens in October 1971. Only days after this announcement, the price of land surrounding the property that the Disney organization purchased for supposedly about $180 an acre will shoot up to $80,000 per acre. And it will go well beyond that, like triple that, a little while after that. As of this day, Disney planners have acquired about 27,443 acres, about 43 square miles, because they added on after their initial purchase. And it cost, at the time, around $5 million. And that answers also one of our Q&A questions from last week that we didn't get to.
Yeah, yep.
So it worked out. So anyway, okay. All right, November 16th. the 29th Disney animated feature film premieres on November 16th, 1990, along with a 25-minute animated Mickey Mouse featurette. So, Craig, do you know the name of the film and the featurette?
I definitely know the name of the film. That was The Rescuers Down Under.
Yes.
And here's the tough part, because I believe I actually did see Rescuers Down Under in the theaters. I mean, I would have been three, but I remember seeing it. I have a feeling I know the animated featurette.
Mm-hmm.
Because this was one of my favorites when I was a kid. And essentially, there's only two, like, 30-minute featurettes that I know of. And one of them is Mickey's Christmas Carol, but that came out in the 80s. So the only other one I know is The Prince and the Pauper.
Mm-hmm. You are correct. Yeah. And The Rescuers Down Under, of course, is a sequel to the 1977 The Rescuers. So, this film was the first traditionally animated film to be painted digitally on computers instead of acetate cells and paints. So,
it's underrated.
Yeah, it is. I remember that one scene where they're flying on that, was it an eagle or something?
Yeah, on the eagle.
I thought, oh my gosh, I just thought that was so magnificent.
Yeah, it was so well done. So just kind of struck out with bad timing on when it was released, right after Little Mermaid, right before the juggernaut movies that were to follow with Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and Lion King right after. Not enough to exceed those, but still just a solid entry in there.
Yeah, they pretty much wrote off the film.
Yeah.
When it didn't meet expectations, opening weekend they pulled all advertising. They just gave up on it.
Yeah, it honestly it reminds me of Lot. I know this one had a little bit more success, and you'd probably hate it more. But it reminds me a lot of kind of the same fate that the Winnie the Pooh sequel had back however many years ago now, because it came out right after Tangled, and then had Wreck-It Ralph, Frozen, all these just big movies to follow it, and it's people like it, but it never really got any huge praise.
Yeah, I thought it was a sweet film, and it was hand-drawn animation. I went to a special D23 premiere at El Capitan, so where they had like the original art, the artists there, and all that. I mean, it was really cool. So, in fact, my plush Winnie the Pooh wears my pass from that because it says Winnie the Pooh on it.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, okay. So our final one for this week, November 17th. On November 17th, 2004, the Walt Disney Company launched a new website dedicated to promoting certain characters whose new film would air on ABC TV the next day. Name the characters and name the film if you want.
I do not know this.
Well, I am so disappointed in you. You mean The Muppets Wonderful Wizard of Oz does not stick in your head? Disney launched an all-new Muppets website. The site, which debuted on November 17th, features games, biographies of the Muppet characters, screensavers, and news about current projects, including the new film, The Muppets Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which is scheduled to air on ABC TV next May.
Yeah, so I have a lot of Muppet stuff. This is not one that I have collected. I did not care for it, so I'm happy saying I don't know this one.
So anyway, the Walt Disney Company purchased the Muppets, of course, in April 2004. So I think I saw this, and I wiped it from my memory. I think, because was Gonzo Dorothy?
No, it was the pop star that was Dorothy.
I don't even remember. I have this image of Gonzo in my head dressed as Dorothy. I don't know why.
I can't, who the heck was it that was, it's not...
It's not Diana Ross, is it?
No, it was a pop star. It was a pop star of that time. Like, there's no way she's still around to this day. But yeah, it's...
You mean she's no longer with us, or her career has faded?
I believe her career has faded.
Did this kill it?
Sure, it couldn't have helped it, but yeah, it's... I love Muppets. I mean, we go over that over and over again, but and I think Kirk Thatcher is very, very important to everything with the Muppets and Henson, but he's also made some very terrible things with the Muppets, and this is one of them.
Ashanti.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. One of those pop stars of the mid-2000s that I could not remember for the life of me. I know the name. I couldn't even tell you one song she sang.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even remember the name. It sounds very pretty. Oh, Gonzo was the Tin Man.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. 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 I probably haven't seen it since 2005, 2006 maybe. So...
Fonzie was the lion. He looks cute. Anyway, all right. Well, good job, Craig. Well, we are looking forward to seeing you at Destination D. And if you can't be there, we will talk about it on future episodes of Connecting with Walt.
Yeah.
So, Craig, until next time, where can our listeners find you on the Diz Unplugged network of shows?
As always, you can find me Tuesdays on the Walt Disney World Edition podcast, Wednesdays on the Best and Worst of Walt Disney World, Thursdays on the Universal Edition podcast, random days on the Diz Daily Fix, and then always on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Teleclaster. What about you, Michael?
Well, you can send me messages at michael@wdwinfo.com. That is where I actually prefer you send me messages, because I have so many messages now on all my other little social media places, I've lost track of them all. So just send them all here. On Twitter, I'm at mbowling121. Michael Bowling is Facebook. That is my page. Check out the one with the Connecting with Walt banner. That actually has the Disney stuff on it. Instagram, I'm Michael Bowling the Diz. And you can connect with both me and Craig on our official Connecting with Walt Twitter page, at Connecting Walt. If you would like to listen to more shows on the history of Walt Disney, his studio, his Imagineers, and Disneyland, check out our Disneyland podcast archives for my Disney history episodes at disunplug.com, and look for past episodes of Connecting with Walt on iTunes, where you can subscribe to our show and leave some positive reviews and ratings. Thank you for making us a part of your day, and remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother Roy.